Hello, and welcome to The Reading Room, the Diagnostic Imaging Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Whitney Palmer. Today, I am joined by Dr. Shalom Kalnicki to discuss the challenges racial and ethnic minorities face in accessing cancer screening services, as well as the impact COVID-19 has had on this existing problem. Dr. Kalnicki is the Chair of Radiation Oncology at Montefiore and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he walked us through the various disparities that exist to make it harder for these patients to get the screening services they need.
All right, well, Dr. Kalnicki, I really appreciate you taking the time to jump right in, and I guess to provide some context around this topic. When it comes to screenings for patients, what challenges, you know, prior to the pandemic, did racial and ethnic minorities already face in accessing these services? And then what difficulties did COVID put on top of that?
The answer is a resounding yes. And the difficulties that people talk about a lot in cancer care, but not enough as they relate to cancer screening, relate to the minorities and disparities, populations, issues with the financial toxicity in cancer care. This is a well-known phenomenon. So imagine a woman, young woman, who has a mammogram, right? Simple for screening mammography, breast cancer, needs surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. That woman who comes from a perspective of total health will have in 1 year, in the year following, a minimum of 140 specialty encounters. Now you take a regular health plan that everybody takes from their employer that says the copay is $15 for a primary care physician, $35 for a specialist. Boom, 35 times 140 minimum in 1 year. So for economically stressed populations, financial toxicity of cancer, and this is just the cash, not to speak about stretches with job losses, not to speak about family care, not to speak about everything that comes around it. For them, it is so immense, and it goes around those communities that they don't want to know. They don't want to know they have cancer as a stress and financial toxicity prevention maneuver, because almost everyone with the incidence of cancer knows someone whose life was tremendously affected from the socioeconomic standpoint by being successfully treated for cancer. And we underappreciate that tremendously. We are blessed to be in a country with 22 million plus circulating cancer survivors. We fail to take proper care of them when they belong to the minority and socioeconomic distress population, give them the benefits they need, the social and economic support they need. So when this backtracks toward cancer screening, the question is, if I have cancer, no matter, you can cure me, but it may ruin my life. Right. It may, and I don't want to get into this. And this is huge and tremendously underappreciated. We talk about health literacy. We talk about socioeconomic factors in terms of knowing all about when should I have mammograms, the different, when should one have, you know, PSAs and CT screening for lung cancer. This is all great, but we do not correlate it. And we on the treatment side feel this every day. We don't correlate by saying to the minorities and socioeconomically distressed populations, don't worry. If you have cancer, the system will take you by the hand and you will end up in a good place. We will make the maximum effort that the day you have the screening mammogram and the day you finish your treatment, you will be as close as possible to your normal life. It will happen to a middle class, socioeconomically stable person in much higher proportions than it will happen to a socioeconomic distressed or minority population. And we see them running away from screening because they don't want to know. So this is the socioeconomic factor of the well-known financial toxicity of cancer care, as we call it in publications, is something that makes them run away from it all. And this is the number one in our head. The second piece is the idea that in cancer screening, many populations who have low health literacy levels and listen to advertisement of drug companies, healthcare hospitals, institutions, and if that your health and healthcare institutions, hospitals, and so on. If you put together the whole bulk of advertising of insurance plans, providers, pharmaceutical and device companies, and so on, they believe that we screen because we need to feed that monster, which is the healthcare system grind, and they don't trust us. And people with low literacy level, the first question they ask us is, can you guarantee that I really have cancer? And you feel like, how does somebody who knows very little in terms of health literacy, how do you explain what cancer is, what the dangers are, and the importance of treatment compliance? So it is not just, in our view, throwing people into screening. Screening has to be a consequence of true population health. And the same way we have now a growing population of vaccine deniers because of issues we have in health literacy and our failure to explain to everyone what it means, I feel we have a growing population of screening denials. So these two factors make the proper reach to the distressed populations a very specific scientific research, a population health research and approach issue that we dedicate ourselves tremendously in trying to understand better what the barriers are and why we are dealing with this in such a manner.
So then with that as a backdrop, is there anything that the pandemic has added on top of that that has made it even, you know, more difficult perhaps to bring these patients in for screening?
It has put in fear of leaving your pod or cocoon. It has added that at a logarithmic level. And we have also incredible logistics problems, because for the patient, or you shouldn't call patient, because if you are doing a lung CT for lung cancer screening, a low dose CT, you are talking about a healthy person who just happens to be smoking maybe. So it's really for the population screened logistics have become much harder. Social distancing. You were 15 minutes late for a screening appointment. You'll have to wait 1 hour, but we'll squeeze you in. You are 15 minutes late for a screening appointment because of New York traffic or because of childcare or because your job asked you to stay a little longer. If you are socioeconomic or otherwise distressed by all those things, like minorities and socioeconomic distress populations are, we have to reschedule it. And you cannot just hang out in waiting rooms like before and things like that. So even a simple, quick screening low-dose CT, you know, we have to screen for the COVID symptoms, we have to do this, do that, and with all the COVID safety, the give and take between the facility and the person being screened has to be much more precise and much more organized. And with the multiple failure points in an urban setting where the minority and the stressed populations usually live, it's very, very difficult.
Right. So then what can be done potentially, you know, in this environment that we have now that's just kind of lingering on and potentially going to get worse as the colder weather comes around? What can be done to encourage these patients to come back in? And then what strategies or techniques can potentially be used to make that a reality?
The number one thing that people have to separate is to help people with health literacy levels who are really basic, understand the difference between a social gathering and an organized flow in a healthcare facility that is maintained COVID safe by the stricted standards. It's a hard thing for individuals who don't have an innate sense of sterility and health safety matters brought in. So the first thing one has to do is to understand how people's head works and why people are scared. In April and May, you circulated through New York City, the neon sign said, wash your hands. It was a great thing. Wash your hands with soap, actually, they said. And it was a great thing. We forget that we have to reinforce basic things in people. And what the difference between being clean, dirty, safe, unsafe, et cetera, has to be much clearer in people's heads. It's not just, the issues about the mask. That's the most visible thing. This is huge too, but obviously. But we need to make people understand that when they come to us, they are safe. After that, we need to make people understand that in a time that they don't know what the future of their health insurance plan, what the future, and this is the difficult part, what the future of their job, health insurance, et cetera, will be, we are going to take them by the hand, and we are not going to dump them if they end up having cancer. That's their basic fear, because the problem that we see when we talk to minorities and distressed populations who get positive diagnosis, who get the diagnosis of cancer, is very simple. You have decades where your health insurance was based on a job, you have the highest unemployment rates, at least since the Great Depression in the 20s, in the 1920s, and everybody is uncertain. So putting the COVID fear and the uncertainty regarding that is very expensive cancer pain care going to be paid or not, I stay away. I stay home and pray that I have nothing. That's there. And it's such a logical reaction. And if we need to, as a society, we need to take a deep breath and make, you know, health care to a certain extent a right of the disadvantaged populations to get them into screening big time. If it is very important that we solve that problem.
So are there any strategies or initiatives that your institution has implemented to not necessarily target, but, you know, concentrate on these groups to give them that comfort level that they need to come back in for screening?
Yes, we tell them that we are going to take them by the hand. We are going to help them if they get a positive screen, we won't dump them. We are going to help them get emergency Medicaid. We are going to get them to sit, a social worker or a financial advisor is going to sit with them and get into an exchange and get them in somehow, that we are going to create something that will not abandon them. And that's the only way we found to get them really to start coming back, that we are safe, we are clean, we actually are paying much more attention in transportation and family issues for appointments, because it disturbs our logistics so much. And you can imagine in a busy radiology practice where you are lining up patients for mammography, lung CTs, and all the other screening and imaging procedures that all this takes. So we pay a lot more attention in helping patients organize lives around their appointments. So we have something called Care 360 that we use for patients for our high-risk clinics, where screening is very important. And we use them also for our cancer survivorship screenings, where social workers continuously via telehealth access barriers to care. And logistics is big. So we have transportation systems, we have, you know, answering of safety questions, we have issues with all these logistic issues that prevent those patients from coming. We try to knock them off one by one.
All right. Well, then pivoting and looking at the role of the radiologist in particular, mm-hmm. is there anything that the provider can do, either on the front end or during the appointment itself, that can really kind of augment this feeling of comfort that the patient has and help them understand that this is, you know, a service that they need to be sure they stay on top of?
The radiologists partner with us in a big way in two key aspects. Number one is quick input. If somebody has a mammogram or a low-dose lung CT for cancer screening, they don't sleep until they hear. So the radiologists partner with us in considering cancer screening a psychiatric urgent matter. That's the approach we take. It's not just an image on their station, workstation. There is somebody trembling at home waiting to get our call and saying, you are fine. or saying you are not fine, it's BI-RADS 4, let's say, and you have an appointment with the breast team tomorrow morning. So that's how it's key that the radiologist partner with us. And the other key partnership in these times of high tension is the time between suspicious and intervention. So that stereotactic breast biopsy, that that transthoracic biopsy of the lung nodule, that the interventional procedure that follows that, especially for patients who are minorities and distressed and have all these COVID logistic problems, and the idea of having cancer is like the drop that spills the water in terms of stress levels, especially with that. The timeline of care is key. It cannot be like, you know, call our access center and we'll see when we can do this. So it has to be a really orchestrated timeline of care, not to make people flip out completely. So the partnership with the radiologist to achieve that is huge. And that's how they actively promote screening by creating this kind of level of service that deflates the tension balloon rather than make it explode.
All right.
The participation of the radiologist is key in that.
All right. Well, it sounds like there have been a lot of positive steps put in place, but again, it's a very, you know, difficult environment right now. So are there still challenges or stumbling blocks that you have picked up on in bringing patients back in for screening despite your best efforts?
Despite the best efforts, we are not at 2019 levels. We are still trailing. When we are, it's, and especially the populations we are talking about are still trailing by a factor. Depending on the subspecialty that you look in the 14 disease-based cancer universe, where we have screening and prevention, diagnostic and therapeutic and survivorship tracks. So we look at this by the 14, you know, cancer groups, head and neck, breast, colorectal, blah, blah, blah. So then we look at that like this, depending, it swings between 20 and 5%. So there are places we are doing better than others, but we are still trailing. And to accomplish this, the challenges are, number one, new vehicles of public education via telehealth. The idea of doing what we were doing in the past, going to churches, schools, community centers, parent-teacher association meetings, and talking about mammography, colonoscopy, CT colonography, PSA. That's dead. We need to figure out, you know, what to do. And this is, you know, how to reach for out to these populations. So we are embarking now for things like cancer screening, HPV vaccination, and so on. We are embarking now on a YouTube channel type of approach and making short YouTube videos in Spanish and English first to make sure that we reach out to the populations. And we are going to try to send the community centers, the parent teachers associations, the church-based, the faith-based organizations, everybody, our public health department is going to keep sending people links, and we are going to see how that works. So we are actively looking for telehealth sort of, you know, we think of telehealth about like telehealth visits and so on, and radiology images on remote screens, but we are thinking of telehealth approaches to cancer screening and prevention.
Right, excellent.
And embarking, this is the program for the last 3 months of this year that we are heavily moving into, and we'll see how it works and how it affects the.
Well, that was my next question. Have you seen an impact of this yet, or is it still kind of ramping up?
We have just started. The people who started coming because of it love it, and and we are finding something very interesting. We have relied for years in reading materials, written pamphlets in waiting rooms, local newspapers, putting, you know, pieces of colorful papers in community and faith-based organizations and so on. People like the screen. And grandma may not be so active on the screen, but you know, the child who is in the 40s who sees the YouTube video will tell grandma to come for her mammogram, and will drive her and wait in the car, we will go to the street, take her in safely, we deliver her back to the car, and it works. It's anecdotal. We will have numbers next year because we are tracking this very, very carefully. And I hope that in a year from now, I can give you beautiful numbers, but I don't know yet.
Well, fingers crossed, because it sounds like a great initiative and a great way to reach people. That you can't access through, you know, traditional or previous methods.
Correct.
Well, I appreciate this. Is there anything else about the need to access these patients and bring them back in that we have not touched on that you think would be important to include to kind of give people a very comprehensive view of the importance of this and what you're doing?
Was the lack of awareness by even the healthcare population, the providers population, is such that spreading out the word that the minorities and socioeconomically distressed populations need help desperately in the cancer screening to treatment continuum and how it affects their lives is fantastic, because we all have hopes that we are still a community-minded society at large, that we build a society based in certain immutable parameters, that we are here for each other in a way. And I believe that awareness is the beginning. We manage the cancer service line by sharing data and saying almost nothing. You know, you put the data in and you hope that people will react positively, and they do. So what you are doing by putting it out there, we need to think about those populations. We need to think about these patients. We need to create a network that helps them get to the desired health outcome. Is I think, extremely important work.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Thank you, Dr. Kalnicki, for joining me. And thank you for listening to The Reading Room. And as always, visit www.diagnosticimaging.com for the latest in radiology news.